Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the New York Times is having trouble squaring its hire of climate change denialist Bret Stephens for a regular opinion column with its current PR campaign branding the paper a bastion of rationality in a dangerously alt-fact moment. Stephens, a white man, like nine of the other 12 current columnists, is also known for columns he wrote at the Wall Street Journal like Haiti, Sudan, Côte d'Ivoire, Who Cares? That argued that colonialism was the best thing to happen for some people. Is that what Times editorial page editor James Bennett meant in describing Stephens as a beautiful writer with a deep sense of moral purpose? FAIR editor Jim Narikas will join us to talk about the sad sort of sense that the Times decision makes. Also on the show, it's easier to reduce climate disruption to a parlor game if you're accustomed to ignoring the real people affected by the fact that decisions of vast and irreversible impact are left to profit-driven extractive industry. Chevron's actions in Ecuador show how hard a company will work to pollute the conversation, along with the land and the water, and what the stakes are for anyone who dares to stand up to them. We'll hear the latest on that from Paul Pazimino, Associate Director of Amazon Watch. Those stories are coming up, but first, a very quick look back at recent press. As we record the show, the House has narrowly approved a Republican bill eliminating many provisions of the Affordable Care Act. There's been, naturally, no public demand to strip millions of Americans from life-sustaining insurance. Such measures gain purchase in part because of nominally liberal media like the New York Times, whose obsession with reporting that the truth is somewhere in the middle, no matter what the facts say, led the paper to downplay the risk to sick children posed by the ACA's elimination. In a May 3rd fact check on the ACA, Times reporter Linda Chu was careful to call into question two Republican and two Democratic statements. One of the Democratic statements was from House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. Quote, up to 17 million children who have pre-existing conditions can no longer be denied coverage by insurers, close quote. Well, first, Chu rephrased Pelosi's statement, removing the qualification up to, quote, Representative Nancy Pelosi, Democrat of California, said the Affordable Care Act insured 17 million children with pre-existing conditions, close quote. Then the reporter debunked not Pelosi's actual statement, but her own paraphrase of the statement. Quote, this is misleading. Ms. Pelosi's office cited a 2011 Department of Health and Human Services report, but the 17 million figure is the upper limit of the department's estimates. The report's lower figure, 4 million, is a fraction of that, and most of those children already had coverage before the Affordable Care Act, close quote. Well, obviously, it is not misleading to cite an upper limit with the phrase up to. That's what up to means. But when you read the HHS report that Pelosi was referencing, the Times is being even more deceptive. The 4 million and 17 million figures are not the low and high estimates of the government about the same phenomenon. They're counting two separate things. The first, lower estimate, uses eligibility guidelines from state-run high-risk pools. The second, higher estimate, the one Pelosi cited, is based on major health insurers' underwriting guidelines. Well, the pre-existing conditions identified by insurance companies themselves as resulting in denial of coverage, reduced benefits, or higher premiums are clearly a better gauge of what conditions require the ACA's protection than state high-risk pool guidelines. Pelosi's statement is not misleading. What is misleading, and dangerously so, is the New York Times' effort to minimize the dangers that ACA repeal poses to sick children in order to maintain their own self-image as even-handedly critical of both major parties. Fair calls on the Times to correct their inaccurate fact check. Listeners can certainly join in on that. Times public editor Liz Spade's email is public@nytimes.com. Please remember that respectful communication is generally most effective. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. With Native American, labor, and children's groups prominent, tens of thousands, perhaps 200,000 people gathered in the nation's capital April 29th for the People's Climate March, re-identified this year as being about climate, jobs, and justice. The D.C. demo, part of some 350 solidarity events around the world, was reported accurately as overwhelmingly peaceful, with demographically diverse crowds and creative signs. But respectful coverage still missed the point. Huge numbers of all sorts of people are being driven to the streets out of fear. Not an abstract fear of fantastical planetary destruction, but also not only fear of the already occurring effects of human-caused environmental disruption. Effects being borne first by people poorly positioned to advocate for themselves on the political stage. It's also a fear that when we urgently need to marshal forces to meet the crisis and heal the harms disruption brings, we're instead actually going backwards, due certainly to the alternative fact pollution of Donald Trump et al., but sadly not to that alone. The New York Times, of late vigorously branding itself as a reality check, a bastion of rationality in a post-truth world, outraged and genuinely surprised many by choosing the present moment to give a regular column to former Wall Street Journal deputy editorial page editor Brett Stevens. Jim Narikas is editor of Fair's newsletter Extra and of our website, fair.org. He's here to talk about the New York Times decision. Welcome back to Counterspin, Jim Narikas.
Thanks for having me on again.
Well, there seems to be a kind of pretense that writers get hired to see what they'll do, you know, so we should wait and see. But outlets like the New York Times aren't throwing a seed to see what might grow, you know. They hire writers based on what those writers have done. So what do we know about what Brett Stevens has done?
Brett Stevens does have a record at the Wall Street Journal, and you can see what kind of writer he is. He's the kind of writer who publishes articles like Global Warming as Mass Neurosis and Palestine, the Psychotic Stage. He's published defenses of torture. You know, this is the kind of writer he is. And the New York Times is insisting that we need to broaden the range of debate so we can have climate denial and anti-Arab racism and torture advocacy as part of our news diet. And I really want to ask, like, why? Why do we want to have someone denying that the greatest calamity facing the planet, that it is happening? Why do we want to have people who talk about the disease of the Arab mind as their explanation for Mideast conflict? Why is this helping the discussion? What are we adding to our intellectual diet by reading these views on the pages of the New York Times op-ed page?
You're talking about racism and pro-torture advocacy, and for a lot of people, that has actually been off the page, and all the focus has been about climate, you know, and so it's interesting that his very first piece was about climate, and the one fact that it had, they had to add a correction to it. But the direction you're taking it, I mean, the fact that they had to correct the one fact in his first column kind of tells you really that it's not about facts for them, you know, that the facts are kind of secondary. And, you know, Susan Matthews at Slate had a piece about how his piece wasn't really about facts. It was really kind of classic denialism in saying, aren't we all uncertain? Isn't everything uncertain? You know, people thought Hillary Clinton would win the election and they were wrong, and that's much more insidious, you know, and it's much more Timesian. You know, classy people find nuance in everything.
You can tell by reading that column, he does not know anything about the climate. He does not care anything about the climate. What he cares about is antagonizing liberals. And he did this very effectively at the Wall Street Journal and got applause from his readers there. Now his role is slightly different. And he was like mocking the idea of global warming when he was at the Wall Street Journal and saying that people who believed in global warming were members of a cult and confidently predicted that in 100 years, temperatures would be the same as they are now. Now he's at the New York Times and he is, I'm very thoughtful and I'm thinking that we're too certain about things and we should be less certain.
Right.
And he throws out this fact as an example of the kind of thing that we all agree on about climate, and it garbles it completely. It's a one fact in the column, and he flubs it. He describes the global temperature rise as the northern hemisphere temperature rise. And now he claims, oh, yeah, well, there is some contribution to that humans are giving to global temperature rise, but we really can't say for sure how much or what we should do about it. Or the effect is the same. Let's not do anything.
Right.
But now he's got a more Timesian approach to it.
I find it so galling because part of what he's saying and part of what defenders from the Times editorial page are saying on Twitter and elsewhere is, oh, people who are critical of Stevens don't want to have a conversation, you know. Now, of course, it's galling on the first level of, no, we don't want to have a conversation about slavery either. We think some things are done and we want to move on. And here, too, there's so much conversation to be had about how the world would respond to climate change. There's so much to talk about.
Yes, yeah.
We have to retrofit an economy. We have to, you know, there's a whole lot to talk about. It's not that people don't want to have a conversation.
The actual debate in science that's going on about global warming is how bad the effects will be. There are reasons to think that there are multiplier effects in the climate that will make the temperature rise much worse. You know, and the effects that humanity will have to endure are much greater. That is the actual debate that serious people are having about the serious disaster that is affecting the world. And the New York Times would rather be able to say, well, we have the people who say global warming is quite serious and we should do something about it someday. And we also have the people who say it's not so serious and we don't need to do anything about it right now. And that's the debate that they want to have, because that is the debate that you can have at your cocktail party and everyone will feel pretty comfortable about that debate.
And Liz Spade, the ombud, had talked earlier about a lack of diversity. She talked about being blinded by the whiteness of the New York Times newsroom. Now she's defending the Stevens hire in the name of diversity and this idea of, well, you know, it doesn't matter that we're adding another white man to an overwhelmingly white male opinion page because his marginality is ideological. And so, you know, how dare you liberals not recognize that?
The idea that you are increasing the ideological diversity of the New York Times by adding Bret Stephens, there are three Republican white men who don't like Donald Trump on the New York Times op-ed page. That's a quarter of their columnists. It's really a pretty small sliver of the American population. There aren't that many Republican white men who don't like Donald Trump out there. Yeah. But they're well represented on the New York Times op-ed page. If you wanted to actually increase the ideological diversity of the New York Times op-ed page, you could add people that are to the left of Hillary Clinton, which is the pale beyond which you must not go in political debate in the New York Times. You do not have any people who are strong advocates for single payer. You do not have people who are saying that there should be reparations for slavery. These are the kinds of issues that are just too far out there for the New York Times to take on. But we'll add another never-Trumper from the GOP instead.
Well, and I think people are right to wonder what it may mean. I mean, as we've been saying, the focus has been overwhelmingly on Bret Stephens' climate change denial, but the fact that he's a racist is very meaningful because you have to wonder if the Times thinks it's okay to entertain the idea that climate change is in some way uncertain, how do we then rely on them to report with proper emphasis on the hardships and the dislocations that millions of people around the world are already experiencing, and women and people of color are on the front line of that, because those are the marginalized people that Bret Stephens has made clear that he doesn't care about.
He had a column at the Wall Street Journal headlined, Haiti, Sudan, Cote d'Ivoire, who cares? Three black countries, And the point of it is that we really shouldn't pretend we care about these countries and we should just give up on them. He did say colonialism may be the best thing that could happen to at least some countries in the post-colonial world because of the depravity of the locals. This is the way the alt-right talks. He's not far from that neck of the ideological woods. And who cares about the people who will be first affected by global warming as well?
Well, we're going to be, of course, doing more on this at FAIR because we're talking about ideological diversity, which is what the Times is focused on. But, of course, there's a straight-up diversity. You know, the idea that Bret Stephens can be introduced as another white man and that doesn't matter because somehow he's representing an undervoiced perspective, and that allows the Times to set aside questions of race and gender. And, of course, they say, as they always do, they're going to get to that. You know, they're getting to that. But there's something very basic going on here about who gets to speak.
The New York Times wants to have a very circumscribed discussion where you have people representing the liberal establishment, the pro-business. That has to be the left edge of debate. And you need people like Bret Stephens to be the people that the Paul Krugmans and the Thomas Friedmans will argue against. And as long as that's the only argument that we can have, then the wealthy people who own the New York Times will never see their wealth threatened. They can rest assured that there's no danger of redistribution of wealth, which is what is really the New York Times, much more than climate change. That is what they are really worried about there.
Jim Noricas is the editor of FAIR's newsletter Extra and of our website, FAIR.org. Thank you, Jim Noricas, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
When we talk about environmental justice, the emphasis is usually on the first word. That might be what comes to mind first when you think about Chevron, formerly Texaco, dumping some 16 billion gallons of toxic oil waste into the land and water of indigenous and farmer communities in Ecuador. But when, having poisoned these communities, which have seen increases in cancer and other health problems, Chevron refuses to clean it up and instead embarks on a decades-long effort to intimidate and silence anyone who tries to call attention to the disaster they've created and profited from, well, then it's clear that it's a story about justice. And in this case, years and years of cross-national organizing and solidarity. Here with the latest on Chevron in Ecuador is Paul Pazimino. He's associate director at Amazon Watch. He joins us now by phone from here in New York. Welcome to Counterspin, Paul Pazimino.
Thank you.
Well, let's start right where we are. Environmental and human rights groups, including Amazon Watch, have just filed two amicus briefs to the Supreme Court. Each has an importantly distinct focus, but they both are aimed at reversing a particular lower court ruling. What did that ruling say?
So that ruling was a retaliatory countersuit against the very people that, as you mentioned, Chevron deliberately poisoned. What Chevron did was they began a suit in New York right before the verdict was to be announced in Ecuador, knowing, of course, that they were going to lose because the evidence against them was so overwhelming. They went back, ironically, to the very same place that the Ecuadorians first tried to seek justice, and Chevron argued, as Texaco, that it was improper to sue them in New York, but then went back there and preemptively waged an attack using the RICO Act. It's a racketeering law that was created to go after the mob in the 70s. Saying that the Ecuadorians, Amazon Watch, Rainforest Action Network, and many others were involved in a vast conspiracy to extort money from them and that the case in Ecuador was actually a fraud, and they tried to get a U.S. federal judge to prevent them from collecting on what was to become a $9.5 billion judgment. Now, the thing about this RICO case in New York was the judge was incredibly biased against Ecuadorians. He recommended the RICO suit himself. He referred it to his own court, and he refused to allow the contamination to even be brought up as evidence in the case. So So he gave Chevron everything it wanted, and he ruled for them. And then that was appealed to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. The Second Circuit inexplicably held up the decision. And part of the reason, we believe, is because Judge Kaplan, the first federal judge, wrote a 500-page verdict and threw so much of basically Chevron's story that the higher court didn't feel able to go through the tome that he had written to look at the facts in that case and ruled specifically on the law and allowed it to be upheld. And the irony is that the law, RICO, being used this way, has many problems that the Supreme Court needs to consider, not the least of which is it was used to intimidate organizations and individuals to suppress their free speech rights. Amazon Watch, for example, was hit with subpoenas to get every document for over a decade of campaigning related to Chevron, and it was simply meant to try to bog us down, to scare us, and to make us have to find lawyers and defend ourselves in court. Now, we defeated their subpoenas soundly in federal court in San Francisco before a different judge who recognized this as nothing more than an attempt to go after our free speech rights and threw out every request that Chevron had. But in New York, under Judge Kaplan, those types of requests were affirmed. And that's the danger if this case is not overturned, because RICO could be used by other corporations, as it is, against environmental groups like Greenpeace and Rainforest Action Networks currently, to prevent people from waging these types of campaigns simply for fear of legal action without having actually done anything wrong other than publicizing information about environmental crimes committed by corporations. Now, that was the first part of it. The second part, which is incredibly important as well, is that the case that Chevron brought was based on the testimony of a corrupt judge who said that he was given a bribe by the Ecuadorians to ghostwrite the verdict in Ecuador, the $9.5 billion judgment against Chevron. Now, since that court found in favor of Chevron, that judge has gone before another tribunal and admitted that he lied about the bribe. And forensic evidence from the government of Ecuador has actually proved that the judgment was not ghostwritten, and it was actually prepared by the appropriate judge, and no external devices were held to it. So the Supreme Court, in our brief, is asked to consider that new evidence, which the Second Circuit Court of Appeals did not, and therefore overturned this decision, one, because the law is used to intimidate groups, and two, because the facts of the case prove that Chevron was just fabricating a lie to get out of paying for a cleanup.
You talked about how the actual facts of the pollution were not allowed into consideration, and we're talking about, as I've heard you say, a Manhattan-sized area of toxic waste in the Amazon, and it wasn't an accident. It was an entirely predictable result of cost-cutting measures that Texaco and later Chevron took.
Exactly.
But to call attention to that, as you've said, this legal action named journalists, named bloggers, along with environmental groups as non-party co-conspirators. You know, this, of course, goes directly to our First Amendment rights, I should think, and one hopes the court will see that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it stems even farther into the future of covering this case. For example, Amazon Watch was given leaked videos from a whistleblower within Chevron, and they show Chevron conducting tests at well sites in Ecuador prior to the court doing it and finding contamination at the very sites that they swore they cleaned up. In fact, you can see them on tape going, wait, I give you one job. Don't find any petroleum, and you can't even do that right. You know, they're joking about the fact that they're finding contamination. Now, those videos were verified as authentic by Chevron's lawyers. And when we tried to get national news coverage about them, I had reporters telling me, off the record, we cannot cover your story. There is a smear campaign against you. Chevron's lawyers are using this RICO decision to suppress coverage of this case, saying that a judge has ruled it's a fraud. You can't cover this story, and you can't trust Amazon Watch. And that's how deep this goes. And they've actually gone after reporters who tried to tell that story and tried to smear them. And they've hired PR firms to go after them directly. I mean, there's no boundaries to the things that they tried to do, unfortunately. And this Supreme Court brief goes through a lot of those specifics, but it doesn't even really touch the tip of the iceberg of what Chevron has tried to do. And it's such a dangerous precedent because other corporations have looked at this case already. And the Americans for Tort Reform, a pro-corporate group, famously said Chevron has written a new playbook to go after corporate gadflies, was the term they used. This is a way to shut down corporate accountability groups, environmental groups, human rights groups, and to silence them.
Well, let me just say finally, in the list of groups that are signing on to these two amicus briefs, I see Justice in Nigeria Now, which just underscores these corporations are global, you know, and they're global, but activism is also global. I mean, it has to be, doesn't it, in the force of these transnational corporations?
Yeah. This case in the United States, while it's a terrible precedent for corporate accountability, it actually doesn't offer Chevron any legal remedy to get out of its responsibility in Ecuador, because the Ecuadorians are enforcing their verdict right now in Canada, where Chevron has $15 billion worth of assets, and they feel that they have a strong case. They've so far had rulings unanimously in their favor by the Supreme Court of Canada, and I believe that they're going to be successful eventually in getting justice there. But what it says is in the United States, the place that's supposed to be the bastion of justice and have an impartial justice system is actually coming out incredibly pro-corporate and is telling the world this is not the place you can go, even to bring our own corporations to account.
We've been speaking with Paul Pazimino of Amazon Watch. You can follow this case along with other work on their site, amazonwatch.org. Paul Pazimino, thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's fair.org. And the website is also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.